court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
How you doing today, Tommy?
Whoa, just wonderful there. Mike, how are you?
Couldn't be any better.
Boy, I saw a good-looking guy in the paper there for the last few days.
Are you talking about the infamous ad?
Yeah. Your new law firm announcing they're acquiring such a young lawyerly stud as yourself and flashing your picture in there. Hey, ladies, if you need legal defense, look at this guy. He'll help you out. Wow. It doesn't say that exactly, but I figure that's what they're thinking.
Yeah, I use my blue steel look.
Yeah. Remington steel?
Blue steel.
Oh, okay.
I was going to use Le Tigre, but I did not.
Well, all right.
This is a different look to the Zoolander male model. If you've never seen the movie, then...
I know of the movie, but I never watched it.
Oh. Well, he had several different patented looks. Uh-huh. Blue Steel, Magnum, Le Tigre, but...
Oh, well, no wonder I didn't know what you're saying. I did see your gift that you put in there.
They were all the same look, basically, though.
Oh, okay. Well, you looked wonderful in your picture there, and I know that the firm is going to see a big increase of business with you there because of your knowledge, your expertise, and your just dashing good looks.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm gushing. I think there must be some setting me up for something here. I feel
no, just espousing my brotherly love for you.
I got my eye on you, Smurl.
Don't trust him if he says something nice. He's been around me too long.
This world's jaded me too much. Well, we could go on and on about
how good looking you are.
But instead,
we have a podcast to do.
And much like the topic for today, this is which is going to be a little bit about different defenses and some mistakes, which maybe there's a mistake about you thinking how good looking I am. I don't know. We're going to talk about different defenses that people have presented.
No matter how wacky or bizarre they may be. By the time you hear this, we will have returned from our live visit to Columbus and our trip there. But you're not hearing the live show from Columbus. You're hearing this show.
Yeah, we're going to hold that one at bay for a little bit and release it as a special 100th episode.
Yeah, we're encroaching on 100 episodes, so we decided we're going to save our live show for that.
Encroaching.
Encroaching on it?
That kind of has a negative connotation.
Approaching on it?
Approaching, there we go. Encroaching.
But today's topic was suggested to us by Maxwell Edison in a shiny hammer on our Facebook page, and he posted an article that he came across where a guy was arrested for having child pornography on his computer. Mm-hmm. And his defense was he didn't do it, his cat did.
Yeah, that's right. He tried to say basically that his cat must have walked across his keyboard as he was prone to do. And that's how the child porn got on his computer.
Yeah, he would log in, the cat would walk across, and he said, and strange things began appearing on my computer.
Yeah, and it did not work. In case you're wondering, let me cut to the chase.
You know what I'm wondering, though? You know that guy we talked about a few episodes back that was interested in making domesticated pet porn?
No.
Don't you remember the guy that said that the attorney that said the strangest thing he ever had, he was starting out and he was a young client, and the guy came in, and at first he wouldn't know how young a girl could be that could be in pornography, and they said, you know, she better be of age.
Yeah.
And so that put him off, and he said, how about animals having sex? And his idea was he wanted to make domesticated animal porn because he thought that there was a market out there for people's dogs and cats to want to watch other animals having sex.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I kind of remember that. I tried to forget it, but I kind of remember you talking about it.
Well, what I'm thinking is maybe this guy was onto something. And that cat was trying to reach this domesticated animal porn and, you know, downloaded the wrong thing. being a cat, you know, they got paws, so they're all thumbs. So, you know, maybe he just got the wrong thing. Is, you know, was animal hub, animal porn hub that he was ended up was trying for and got the wrong one or something. I don't know. All I know is it adds a whole new connotation to knick knack patty whack give a dog a bone.
That was the most circuitous roundabout way to get to that joke. I'm sure that you had that joke in mind. You're just trying to keep talking.
No, it was spontaneously combusted.
Okay. Well, I don't have much to say about that, but we've kind of talked about the elements of crimes before, because there's usually two parts to every kind of criminal charge. There's the mens rea, which is the mental aspect, and the actus rea, which is the physical act. So whenever you're talking about different defenses to crimes, usually what you're doing is you're trying to assert that there's something lacking in one of the elements of the crimes. So the basic elements are these two things, the mental and the physical part of it. So in the case of this cat, this guy would basically be a defense to both of them. He's saying, not only did I not have the mental capacity to do it, I didn't actually even do the physical act. So
that damn cat looking for porn.
So he's trying to say it wasn't me at all. That's more akin to saying, like, it just wasn't me. It was somebody else who did it. I don't know how that got on there. Maybe it was the cat. I don't know.
He was looking for kitten porn and got kid porn.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Cats don't spell too well.
But that would be a defense. That's almost like kind of an alibi defense where you're saying it wasn't me. It must have been somebody else or I wasn't there. You can say like, oh, well, this porn was downloaded at 10:53 p.m. on Tuesday. Well, at 10:50 p.m. on Tuesday, I was at the Sheetz getting some gummy bears.
That I'd seen on things I found at Sheetz.
That's right. And so that would be like an alibi defense. So again, you know, those are the kind of defenses. But now
not a good alibi defense, but an alibi defense nonetheless.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I mean, there's been a couple times where I've had somebody who was accused of doing something and during the indictment says it was from this time period to this time period. And they have a pretty airtight defense for part of the time because they were in prison for a different crime. So they couldn't have been the ones who did it during that time.
That's a pretty airtight alibi.
That is a pretty airtight alibi.
Unless you're letting yourself in and out.
That's right.
You know, like, what was his name? Otis that used to do on the Andy Griffith Show?
Yeah. He just kind of lived there.
Yeah. He would just put himself in jail and let himself out.
There's been some other instances where people have been, like, in hospitals during a certain time when they're supposedly have committed a crime. And they actually have medical records, like when, you know, a nurse was coming into the room and checking their pulse or checking their vitals and very accurate records to show that could not have been them during that time. So
again, you're making my argument for chipping everybody. So you wouldn't have to worry about that.
You ain't chipping me. So those are some different kinds of defenses. Now, some of the more interesting ones that you might come across, and hopefully the more entertaining ones for this podcast have to do with, different ones like mistake or involuntary intoxication. Not voluntary, but involuntary. Although voluntary intoxication could, in theory, be a defense to a crime that has some sort of specific intent.
And I'm sure that it has arisen as a defense many a time.
Oh, it has.
I mean, you voluntarily imbibed and over-imbibed.
Yeah.
You say, well, I couldn't help it. I was drunk, Your Honor.
Right, but voluntary intoxication is usually not a defense to any crime.
What if you're just an idiot?
That's not a crime either. Now, if you're insane, that could be a defense.
Well, sure.
Insanity.
I'd say there's more idiots than there are insane people, though.
And based upon my reasoning, do you know why insanity would be a good defense?
Well, because if you're insane, then you don't have any mens reas.
Exactly.
Mens reas. Mens rears.
Sort of.
Whatever it is.
Sort of what you said there.
Yeah.
But yeah, but if you're insane, you don't have the mental capacity to do the crime at the time.
Right. You might have the physical, but not the mental.
That kind of rhymed. Like, that was pretty good. A little Johnny Cochran-ish.
Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
Yeah. So
you know who said that, don't you?
Who's that?
Beretta.
Did he?
Yeah. You remember Beretta?
A little bit before my time, but I know who you're speaking of.
Oh, okay.
I think Beretta was in the 60s.
No, he wasn't that late. He was at least the 70s.
Was it?
Yeah.
No, could have been. I was a young thing in the 70s.
He was involved in his own real life trial and everything.
How so?
His girlfriend ended up dead.
Beretta's girlfriend?
Girlfriend or wife, yeah. And he was accused of doing it, and it was the same type thing. I was in the restaurant. She was in the car waiting for me, and I was in the restaurant. And so they had to poke holes in his timeline. But I don't think they got him. I think he got away with it.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the actor's name?
Blake was the last name. I can't remember his first name.
Well, if you say you think he got away with it, do you mean he was found not guilty?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, so maybe he just was actually innocent.
Well, yeah. So was OJ.
Okay, then.
Touche.
One of the first things I talked about was a mistake. And so there's two different kinds of mistake.
Robert Blake.
Robert Blake was Beretta.
It just came to me, yes. And did you know who else he was?
The name sounds really familiar, but I can't place it.
He was like Spunky or something like that on The Little Rascals way back in the 40s or whatever like that. He was a child actor.
That's not what I was thinking.
Yeah, he was a child actor back in the 40s with The Little Rascals and everything. I can't remember what his name was.
Child actors gone bad.
Yeah.
We could do a whole podcast on that.
Yeah, probably so.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, one of them got run over by a bus. I think it was the...
A child actor?
Yeah, the little brother from Mary Poppins or something. Jane and Michael Banks. Kid that played Michael Banks.
You mean he got hit by a trolley?
Yeah, he got hit by a trolley, yeah.
Would be a trolley since it was Mary Poppins, right?
Well, that's true. He didn't get hit in the movie. It was later on, he was like a teenager, like 18, 19 years old, and I think he was drunk or something, got run over by a bus or something.
A trolley. Okay. So the first kind of mistake is...
A double-decker trolley.
There you go. He was just trying to find the loo.
I guess I keep getting us off track here. Sorry about that.
So the first... I don't even know what I'm talking about. The first, the second, who knows? The first kind is the mistake of fact defense. And typically, this is the kind of mistake where a defendant made what must be a reasonable kind of mistake. So the mistake has to be one that an ordinary person would make in those circumstances. It can't be something kind of crazy and off the wall. Basically, this is kind of one of those things where you didn't really understand everything in there, but it's reasonable that you didn't understand everything in there.
I don't understand your example.
Well, for example, like if you if you were breaking in somewhere to recover what you thought was your property, but in fact wasn't your property, then you could try to argue that, well, that's a mistake of fact. I thought that was mine, but actually it wasn't.
Oh, and I was taking it back. Yeah. Okay.
So, and I actually have a very good, funny example of a real case that involves that. How coincidental is that?
Yeah, that's pretty good. I got one along the same line. So
I came across this case actually when I was doing research for a new case I had, mm-hmm. which I can actually not talk about at this time. But this case is called State v. Shores. And the site, for all you people that like sites out there, I know somebody said they liked to get the different sites to the cases, is 31WV491. So it's just in the West Virginia Reporter. This is an old case. It's from 1888.
That's pretty old.
Yeah. And so it took place in Mercer County, West Virginia.
Okay.
And here's the part that kind of struck my fancy. And I'll just read the little part of the case here. Where it appeared upon... You have to understand these older cases have very kind of colorful writing to them.
Well, they spoke better then than we do now.
They did.
I mean, if you ask me.
Where it appeared upon trial for burglary that three persons, much intoxicated, went into a store and called for cider, which they drank and paid for, went out and came in again and called for more, which was poured out to them and delivered to them in glasses on the counter, and a pistol was discharged in the house, and they all went out, leaving the cider in glasses on the counter, and they returned and found the store lighted, it being 10 o'clock at night, and pushed against the door, which was locked, and broke it open, and they went in, followed by other persons against whom there was no charge or suspicion, and there, in the light and in the presence of other persons, drank the cider. The refusal of an instruction to tell the jury that, under these circumstances, that if they in good faith believed they had a right to drink the cider, that it was theirs, then they did not have the intent to steal the same, is error.
So they made a mistake in that instead of committing a deliberate crime.
That's right. They weren't trying to steal the cider. They thought it was theirs.
But they hadn't paid for it yet.
Well, it's funny you talk about that, because this actually goes into talk about the different procedures of purchasing cider at this particular store.
Tell me about the involved methods of cider purchasing. I can't even say it.
You kind of glossed over the whole thing that I thought was really most interesting, that there was a pistol discharged at some point.
In the facility or outside?
In the facility.
Well, I figure in 1888 in Mercer, West Virginia, that was not uncommon. There's probably pistols discharged on a regular basis. That's what they did in the schoolroom just to get your attention.
I'll read a bit more from the case then. They said Sheriff Schweschke was the owner of a house in Bramwell, Mercer County, West Virginia. That was a tough name to pronounce.
Yeah, I'm glad you had it.
The house contained 5 rooms, 3 upstairs and 2 down. The 3 upper rooms were used for dining room, kitchen, and chamber in which he slept. That the owner kept a store of general merchandise in the 2 lower rooms. That witness was, from the first day of February 1888 to the time of the trial, a clerk or salesman of the owner in said store. The front room of the store housed a front on Main Street of said town. That on the 27th day of February 1888, while he was in the storeroom about 8 o'clock at night, the prisoner and Bailey Hall came into the storeroom, and soon thereafter, State Hall came in. One of them called for cider, which was sold to them by L. Sherishwesky and paid for, and they drank some cider, and also something witnesses thought was bitters. That they offered witness and L. Sherishwesky some of the bitters, which they did not drink. That the prisoner said Halls then left to go to the storeroom, and sometime afterwards, they or one of them returned again and called for a fiddle, and said they wanted to go to some kind of show or exhibition that was in town that night. That there was no fiddle in the house, and they went off again. That about 9:30, or perhaps 10 o'clock, the prisoner and Halls returned to the store and got some more cider. That by this time, they were so drunk they did not know what they were doing. They were very boisterous and did not know what they were talking about. That a man with a black mustache was in the store at that time, whom the witnesses did not know.
Tom Selleck.
That a pistol went off in the house in the hands of either the prisoner or the unknown man. That before the pistol was discharged, the prisoner had called for cider, which the witness poured out for him, 2 glasses full and 4 glasses. Witnesses supposed they wanted to spike it. They put something else into it, witnesses did not know what, and set it upon the counter, the usual place for delivering cider and goods to customers. About the time witnesses poured out this cider, the pistol went off, and witnesses said to one of them he thought it was Bailey Hall to get them out and to stop the shooting, and Bailey Hall said he would, and that a drink did not make him such a fool. That they even started out, that the prisoner fired off his pistol one time when at the door direction of the street, and the witness closed the door and locked it immediately after they had gone out. So basically, the pistol goes off, they go outside in the street, the guy goes over and locks the door.
The owner, Schweitzer, or whatever his name was.
That the cider was worth 5 cents, and after he had locked the door, he left the lights burning in the storeroom and went out through a door in the back room and went up the back stairway, and he saw 2 of the 4 who had gone out in the storeroom standing east on the front corner of the storehouse and heard others near the west front corner, and that they were all talking in a loud and boisterous manner. The witness went out and was gone some time, and when he returned to the storehouse, found the prisoner, the 2 Halls, and John Kennan in the storeroom, and Bacon tried to arrest them, but they resisted. I don't know who Bacon was. He just appeared. Witness examined the store door. The bolt was thrown as if the door was locked. The door was a double one. That one side was fastened by a foot bolt at the bottom and a spring latch up top. Witnesses saw no damage done in any way to the door. So
they put way too much detail in this story.
Oh, it's crazy. It's pretty funny. Sherwesky kept cider in store for sale, and he was authorized to sell it, and they were in the habit of delivering the cider to the customers to drink in glasses on front of the store counter, that sometimes they paid for it before and sometimes after they drank, but they never demanded pay from anyone from cider before they drank it. So they never asked for pay before they drank it.
So in other words, they drank it, and the guy wasn't there to pay him. Otherwise, he'd have paid him.
Pretty much. So it looks like they basically poured the cider out.
There was no signs of forced entry.
2 glasses worth and 4 glasses.
Right, because they were going to spike it.
I think they probably already poured their hooch in there because it said they saw them do it.
Yeah.
So they really had already kind of converted the cider into their own special concoction.
You can't stand between a man and his cider by shutting a glass door.
So they essentially broke in and stole what was already essentially theirs.
But they didn't really break in. There was no signs of forced entry. They said there was no damage, and it was a double lock. A foot lock at the bottom and a spring lock at the top.
Yeah. They pushed against it and just went open, I guess.
They weren't properly administered.
Anyway, that case is a little long-winded, but the detail in it is pretty awesome, and I love the fact that they're drinking cider and shooting off pistols inside a store.
That's unbelievable. And then Bacon showed up.
Well, they called for a fiddle.
They called for a fiddle. Sounded like a John Denver song.
It did.
Called for his pipe, and he called for his fiddle.
It actually is a John Denver song, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank God I'm a country boy.
Yeehaw!
Well, I think there's another kind of mistake that I want to get into, but I think before that we have some motions.
We have a motion to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
Who's on the docket?
Well, today on the docket is our good friends at DollarShaveClub.com.
We love Dollar Shave Club.
Absolutely, we love Dollar Shave Club, and we use Dollar Shave Club. We swear by Dollar Shave Club. We would use nothing else but Dollar Shave Club.
I used Dollar Shave Club products before I had my fashion shoot for my picture in the paper.
Well, and it shows, Michael, because you were glowing.
I used One Wipe Charlie's.
Well, I didn't see that part of you to know if it was glowing. But at least you had that tingly feeling. That's what that smile was all about. I noticed that smile was spectacular. It was the tinglies going on down below.
Well, Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best.
Dollar Shave Club has everything you need to get ready in the bathroom, much more than just razors.
They have shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, and even the aforementioned wipe that'll leave you your tush feeling tingly clean.
I'm a big fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. Never smelled anything like it. Good luck finding a product that great at the store.
Not going to happen. And the thing about Dollar Shave Club is that all of their products are made with top shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. You're going to feel the difference. Plus, shipping is free with your membership.
And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, five measly bucks, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with Body Cleanser, One Wipe Charlie's, their amazing butt wipes, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six Blade Executive.
It's hard for me to choose one of my favorite products from Dollar Shave Club because they're all so good. But man, I love the Dr. Carver Shave Butter. I think it's amazing. But the thing is, I always use that magnificent razor with it too, so they work great together. Just give them a try.
It's like the chicken and the egg. You don't know which came first in the fantastic shave they provide. Was it the shave butter or was it the razor? I don't know. Just keep using them both and you'll never have to worry about it.
Now, if you try the Daily Essentials Starter Set, you can keep the blades coming for just a few more bucks a month. You can add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need.
Check it all out at dollarshaveclub.com/court.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court.
And as always, tell them Mike and Tommy sent you.
They're probably getting kind of tired of hearing that, I would think, at this point.
Never. They'll never be tired of hearing that. Come one, come all.
So now the second type of mistake defense is a mistake of law defense. And this is something that is considered legally impossible to commit and is traditionally considered a valid defense for people who are prosecuted for a criminal attempt. Mistake of law has proved successful defense at certain times. And some examples of this might be like a person who's trying to shoot at a tree stump. The person cannot be prosecuted for attempted murder as there's no manifest intent to kill somebody by shooting a tree stump. They're shooting a tree stump, not a person. So the underlying rationale is basically that attempting to do what is not a crime is not attempting to commit a crime. So it's a little kind of splitting some hairs there.
So if you were walking by in the background and the guy shooting the tree stump shot you, then it wouldn't be murder, although you may still get him for manslaughter or something.
Yeah, exactly. One interesting case is this State v. Mitchell case, and this is one that's used a lot to talk about mistake. And it's a Missouri case, and basically, in this case, the defendant fired some shots into a room at night where the intended victim was usually sleeping, and they were actually trying to murder the person. And one bullet struck the victim's usual pillow, but what the defendant didn't know was that the victim was sleeping elsewhere that particular night. Mm-hmm. So using these circumstances that the bed was empty, the defendant pleaded not guilty on the grounds that the intended crime was factually impossible to commit, as there was no victim into the room into which he fired. At trial, he was found guilty of attempted murder, and the fact that the intended crime was impossible for the defendant to commit was not considered a defense for the charge of attempting to commit a felony, in this case, murder.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Because his intent was to kill him, and as far as he knew, he was in there. He just got lucky, and he wasn't in there. You can't say, well, he wasn't even home. How could I have killed him?
So Mitchell appealed it, and the Supreme Court of Missouri affirmed the conviction and basically said that the objective itself was criminal in nature and only a circumstance unknown to the defendant prevented its completion. and the court held that a person who shoots into the bed of another person on purpose, believing that person to be in bed, is guilty of attempted murder. And they ruled that when the consequences sought by a defendant are forbidden by law as criminal, it is not defense that the criminal, that the defendant could not succeed in reaching the goal because of circumstances unknown to him.
Well, if that was in Missouri, you know what they told him.
What's that?
Show me.
That could be true.
That's probably where it came from.
One of the other interesting things that you hear about, too, is like, and this was kind of cited, too, in this article I was reading, is that a borderline case for a mistake of law might be a person who is trying to shoot a stuffed deer, thinking that it was alive. There was a case like that where a person was originally convicted for attempting to kill a protected animal out of season, but the reversal was is that the appellate judge throughout the conviction says that it's not a crime to shoot a stuffed deer.
Well, that's true, but what if his intent was he thought it was a real one?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Who knows if it was?
Yeah. Well, I know about one where a guy shot another guy's horse because he thought it was a deer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so he tried to bring charges against him. The guy's like, well, I thought I was out deer hunting. And it was legal deer hunting. And I thought it was a deer, and I shot it.
Yeah. Well, one thing, keeping on the whole deer thing that they do a lot, the Department of Natural Resources, is they have these things called robo-deers. Have you ever heard of these?
Robo-deers?
Robo-deers.
Never heard of them.
They're remote-controlled.
I know robots are taking over the world.
They're remote-controlled deer decoys that they set up. And basically what they'll do is they'll use these mechanical robotic deers to put them out at night along the side of the highway and try to entice somebody to shoot
them. Hunt from the highway because you're not allowed to, right?
Yeah. And they move and everything like that. And I wonder if part of the reason why they made them movable is because of the precedent set by that one case that, well, it was a plastic deer he shot. It's not against the law to shoot a plastic deer. But if you see one that's moving, then you can say, you can't say, well, I just thought it was a target and I was target shooting. You can say, hey, I thought it was a real deer. It was moving.
Well, and then most current robot deers are even upgraded further. They shoot back. So if you shoot one of them, instead of it just being a game warden has to be nearby, they just open fire on you. You're fair game at that point.
There was a robot deer decoy in Georgia that had to be replaced in 2006 after it had been shot more than 1,000 times.
Must not have been built as good as the Terminator, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
I'll be Buck.
One of the officers that was talking about it said that, I've seen individuals shoot it with a .30-06 rifle, which is a pretty high caliber rifle for a white-tailed deer, and they couldn't figure out why it didn't go down after they hit it 5 or 6 times. He
said, that's one tough son of a bitch.
He said it can be really entertaining. And he said that poachers are starting to catch on and that they become wary of shooting from the road, not only for fear of arrest, but also fear of embarrassment that comes along with it. That basically, you know, everybody else that is friends with them that's also hunters are going to make fun of them for shooting a robot deer.
Well, a deer starts shooting back and you'll really be embarrassed.
Yeah. There was actually a case not too long ago. It was a misdemeanor in Wayne County when I was out there. There was a DNR officer there prosecuting somebody for shooting a robot deer he was talking about. So, kind of interesting, but
again, I shot a robot. Well, get them before they get us.
That's right.
In my usual research that I do for these things, I tried to come up with, find the 10 craziest legal defenses that actually worked.
Oh, these ones worked, huh?
Yeah, these actually worked. Ones that you wouldn't think so, but they did. Now, this one, probably most everybody's heard of. Affluenza.
Oh, yeah.
In 2013, Texas teenager Ethan Couch, who at the time was wasted, speeding, and driving illegally on a restricted license, plowed into a group of people with his truck. 4 died, 9 were injured. At trial, Couch's attorneys blamed affluenza, a word they coined for affluent and influenza, for Couch's actions. According to Couch's lawyers, his wealth prevented him from appreciating the consequences of his actions. So he didn't have the mens rea because he didn't understand that if I drink and drive and crash into people, they might die and people will be upset about that.
Yeah.
You know, it never occurred to him. He was too rich to worry about those kind of things. They were commoners standing on the sidewalk. Get an Uber. But though Couch was ultimately convicted of 4 counts of intoxication manslaughter, a Texas judge passed up the state's recommendation of 20 years in prison and instead sentenced Couch to probation and rehab. Couch carried out the bulk of his sentence at a facility in Newport Beach, California, which offered horseback riding, karate, and cooking classes. For these luxuries, his parents paid $450,000 a year. Money may have caused problems in Couch's life, but it also saved him from going to prison.
Huh.
So that's pretty bad. But, I mean, who would think of saying that? Well, he was... His upbringing made it so he didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And it worked.
Kind of. Well, I mean, I guess he... Money.
Probation and rehab is all he got.
Yeah.
And he got to learn karate and cooking and...
And he killed four people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And he didn't serve any time, actually.
I don't think that's fair, actually.
No, I don't either. And if you remember, this part of the story is not even in this. His mother took him and ran off to Mexico or somewhere like that to avoid sentencing. She didn't want him to go to prison. So she ran off with him to Mexico. They were eventually tracked down there and brought back for their sentencing, and he still got probation. There is no justice for the very rich. Now, the next one, this is one that we've talked about before. Sleepwalking.
Yeah.
Steven Steinberg fatally stabbed his wife 26 times while sleepwalking.
Oh, we talked about this very case.
Yeah. And Steinberg, who had a history of sleep disturbances, claimed no memory of the events. At trial, Steinberg's attorney, Bob Hirsch, advanced the theory that Steinberg's wife, a woman Hirsch dubbed a Jewish American princess, had driven Steinberg temporarily insane, forcing him into intermittent disassociative states. Apparently, it was during one of these states, akin to sleepwalking, that Steinberg killed his wife. Because Steinberg was deemed sane upon acquittal, he walked out of the courtroom a free man. So, I mean, what I really hate about this is it's kind of victim blaming. They kind of said she deserved it.
Yeah.
Because she was on him so much that she drove him to this disassociative behavior. Got away with it.
Yeah, I don't either. I kind of understand the whole sleepwalking thing, but not the whole victim
blaming. I don't buy the sleepwalking thing.
Really?
No. Not when you, I mean, 26 times, how does somebody stay asleep and stab somebody 26 times? That takes some effort. You know, you don't just roll over. Sorry, hon. Oh, did I stick a knife in your back? Oh, did I do it 26 times?
I guess you could impute that from his actions.
Yeah, I don't buy that. As a guy that's been married almost 40 years, I don't buy that. It's like when they ask the old lady at her 50th wedding anniversary, "In all that time, did you ever think about divorce?" She said, "No, not once. Murder a few times, but never divorce." All right, the next one on the list, gay panic. Have you ever heard of gay panic defense?
I have not.
Jonathan Schmitz had a secret admirer. He agreed to meet the person on the Jenny Jones show. That was a talk show back before, Mari Povich and all those kind of things.
I know which case you're talking about.
And in front of a studio audience of hundreds, when Schmidt walked out onto the stage, he saw an attractive woman. Assuming she was his secret admirer, Schmidt tried to kiss her, playing it up for the cameras. But a producer quickly interjected, "Oh, no, 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 she's not your secret admirer." And there on stage was Scott Amendeur. "This is," the producer grinned, gesturing at Amendeur. There was a twist. This show was about men who had secret crushes on other men. Schmitz was stunned, and the producers had specifically told him his admirer was a woman. They had even planted one on stage. And the woman happened to be a lady that lived at his apartment complex, so he had every reason to believe that was her. Though Schmitz felt foolish, he didn't want to lose his cool on television. He played along, even laughing when Amendeur recounted a fantasy involving strawberries, whipped cream, and champagne with the two of them. But Schmitz couldn't contain his wet rage, and a few days after the taping, found a note on his front of his apartment that made a suggestive overture towards him and said, "Guess who?" Well, he assumed it was Amendeur, so he went to his house, asked him if he wrote the note. He said yes, and at that point, he shot him dead.
Wow.
At the trial, Schmidt didn't contest that he killed Amendeur. Instead, he argued that at the time he was suffering from diminished capacity from the embarrassment he suffered on the Jenny Jones show. Coupled with the shock over finding that note, despite significant evidence of deliberation and premeditation, which is required for finding a first-degree murder, a jury bought Schmidt's gay panic defense and found him guilty of only second-degree murder.
That guy actually was released on parole last year.
Really?
Yeah.
And it says that a lot has changed. That was in 1995, and recently California has banned the gay panic defense. That's no longer a defense. And the American Bar Association suggests other states follow suit. And the next one is sexsomnia. Have you ever heard of sexsomnia?
I have not.
That's evidently somebody who falls asleep but goes around having sex with people. So this woman fell asleep at a Toronto house party, and when she woke up, a man she hardly knew was raping her. "Who the hell are you and what are you doing?" she reportedly demanded. The man on top of her, Jan Ludecki, later claimed he had no idea what he was doing until he woke up in the bathroom and saw he was wearing a condom. So he had enough unsleep to put a condom on, but no, I was asleep. I don't know what I was doing. Apparently, this was nothing new for Ludecki. At his trial, a doctor testified that Ludecki had a history of sleep sex, which was aggravated by the more than 16 alcoholic drinks he had had that night and the magic mushrooms he consumed the day before. Ludecki was ultimately acquitted of sexual assault. The state appealed, but Ludecki prevailed.
What state did that happen in?
Toronto.
Oh, not a state.
Well, it's a province in Canada.
Yeah.
Which is a well-established country that has been around for a while.
I don't think that'd fly under American law. I'm just saying.
You think the Canadians got schnookered?
Maybe. I don't know. That just sounds out there. I've never heard that before at all.
Sexsomnia. Now, this one we like to call busted. Serena Kazakura, a bikini model, was sentenced to a whopping 14 months in prison for trespassing and willful destruction of property. According to prosecutor, Kazakura kicked a hole in her boyfriend's apartment and climbed through it after she discovered him cheating. He had kicked Kazakura out, but she wasn't done arguing. Nor was Kazakura willing to accept the judge's guilty verdict. She appealed, claiming it was impossible for her 40-inch bust to fit through the hole in the door, which was only 28.3 inches by 8.7 inches. Despite eyewitness testimony claiming Kazakura was indeed the perpetrator, the Tokyo High Court bought Kazakura's defense. It was definitely my breast that won the day for me. So she was acquitted upon the higher court reviewing it.
That's just simple math.
Even though witnesses saw her. But we know eyewitnesses are not always reliable.
That's true.
And who knows what they were looking at when there's a 40-inch bust involved.
If the boobs don't fit.
You must acquit. Well, that worked. Hey, Johnny had another one. I bet Johnny was in on that one. Here's another one that we all should be, if we're in a committed relationship, we all should worry about. The PMS defense. During her trial for murder, Jan Painter admitted to stabbing her husband. Yet a Liverpool jury acquitted Painter of all charges after her defense team claimed she was suffering from severe PMS at the time. Painter testified that her husband had taken money from her purse without asking, which upset her, especially because it was that time of the month. So she stabbed him and killed him.
And she
walked.
Really?
Yep. They understood. PMS. Well, of course. He took the money without asking. He got what he deserved.
Well, probably is a bit more to it than that, I'd have to think.
Well, that was pretty much it. The Matrix defense. You heard of the Matrix defense?
I've not heard of any of these.
In 2002, well, you heard of affluenza.
I heard of that.
In 2002, Tonda Lynn Ansley shot and killed her landlord, Sherry Lee Corbett. She pulled the trigger three times. It was broad daylight, and there were several witnesses. Still, Ansley didn't think she was going to go down for the crime. In fact, she wasn't even sure a crime had occurred. In 1999, Ansley had seen The Matrix, and it changed her life. Ansley became convinced she was living inside The Matrix. She also believed that, like Neo, it was her duty to rebel against it. In Ansley's head, Corbett was one of the enemies. So was her husband, and police later learned Ansley planned to kill him, too. So moments after her arrest, she said, "I started having dreams I found out aren't really dreams." In The Matrix, Neo believes an initial experience of his with The Matrix is a dream. And she tried to explain, that's where you go to sleep at night and they drug you and take you somewhere else. And when they bring you back and put you in bed and when you wake up, you think it's a bad dream. A judge approved Ansley's insanity plea on May 13th, 2003, right as The Matrix Reloaded was premiering in theaters.
I was going to say, I don't think that's so much as The Matrix defense. I think that's the insanity defense.
That's what it was. Now, this one's based on DNA. For R. Sathis Raj, his identical twin brother, Sabarish Raj, this wasn't a defense, but a way to avoid prosecution altogether. In 2003, one of the twins was arrested and charged with drug trafficking. In Malaysia, where the alleged crime occurred, this charge was punishable by death. But during the first twin's arrest, the second twin showed up to the scene. Though only one twin allegedly had the drugs, by the time the case got to court, the police were unable to identify the twin they arrested. In fact, it appeared no one could tell them apart. Given that the two men were identical all the way down to their DNA, the judge refused to hear the case. Apparently, she wouldn't risk sentencing an innocent man to die. Once the judge dismissed the case, the twins wept and embraced. So show up. If you got a twin and they get in trouble, show up at the scene, and then they don't know who did it, and so they'll let you go.
I think that was like an episode of Three's Company.
Mr. Furley! This is the oral sex defense.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of that defense?
I have not.
Heather Spiklowski was charged with manslaughter of her boyfriend, Neil Esposito, a prominent Republican campaign manager. Esposito died after his Mercedes-Benz crashed. Prosecutors claimed Spiklowski had been driving the car. Her defense, she couldn't have been driving the car because she was giving Esposito oral sex at the time of the accident. Over the government's objections, the presiding judge, Robert L. Holzberg, allowed Spiklowski to proceed with the defense, stating, "A defendant has a right to offer defense, no matter how outlandish, silly, or unbelievable one might think it will be." He added, "No one ever told me in law school that we'd be having these kinds of conversations in open court." At trial, paramedics testified that Esposito's body was found with his pants down. Spiklowski was acquitted of all charges.
I mean, that sounds like it might fly.
Something.
Yeah. Because the judge is like, well, I'm interested. Let's see where this goes.
And that's about it. This last one was a guy that got a speeding ticket, and they were going to take away his license. And his plea was, look, I've got two wives. One lives in Anwar and one in Glasgow. And he, or Motherwell and the other in Glasgow. His name was Anwar. And he wouldn't be able to keep up because he had to alternate nights with each wife. And he wouldn't be able to do it if they took away his driver's license. So they reduced it to a fine and put points on his license and let him go. So his defense was he had two wives and he had to alternate with them.
So you can't take my license.
That's right. Now, there are some that they use sometimes that they pull out and they don't work.
Have you ever heard of the Chewbacca defense?
No. What's the Chewbacca defense?
That's from South Park.
Oh.
That's when,
so it wasn't a really one that was used.
Kind of.
Hey, I'm talking real law here, dude.
It was on an episode of South Park. There was a Johnny Cochran type character on there. And the basis of his argument was that the fact that Chewbacca was a 7-foot tall Wookiee and he was on a planet with 3-foot tall Ewoks did not make any sense. And therefore, based on that, you must acquit. So the whole premise of his defense was just basically confuse the jurors to the point where they didn't really understand what he was talking about. So they'd have to acquit the guy. In the scene, one of the jurors' heads explodes when he's talking.
That probably would work in a lot of cases.
It might.
If you talk faster than they can think.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do with 3-year-olds.
And jurors.
All right, now these are ones that people tried and did not work out very well. Fake heart attack. This guy named Keezen Wilkins, his incredible defense during his 2008 shooting trial was based heavily on playing dead. Presumably thinking that if he didn't move, the due process would lose interest. The court confirmed Keezen was faking it by using smelling salts. He jerked up like an electrocuted jack-in-the-box before attempting to return to his nap. Having trained medics on hand and not being idiots, they could determine that he was faking. But Keezen was committed to the least convincing portrayal of unconsciousness that doesn't actually involve dancing ever, and kept on napping through the rest of the trial. And is now committed to a 42-year sentence. So he went down and didn't move, and even though they said, look, we know you're faking, he just laid there through the rest of the trial.
It's like you ever see on Cops when they're chasing somebody, and then all of a sudden lose sight of them, they see him go into a house, and they go in the house, and the guy comes down and is like, oh, what? No, it wasn't me. I was upstairs sleeping. It's always a classic.
Well, I see a lot of them that when they catch them and they start handcuffing, they say, oh, I think I'm having a heart attack. I'm having a heart attack. Because they want to go to the hospital rather than go straight to jail.
Yeah.
So they're trying to get out of it. This next one is, Louis Palmer claimed that his victim agreed to a quick fumble. This was in the UK. She agreed to a quick fumble with him late at night.
Okay.
She said he stalked her, pushed her against a wall, sexually, and then actually assaulted her. That's when he won the Nobel Prize for 50s sexism. Announcing that sometimes women need a bit of physical violence to settle their unbalanced feminine vapors. But he was immediately slapped down by the security camera. Oh, and did we mention that this was all on his stag night before getting married? So his defense when he got in there and they, you know, it was the sexual assault and assault. His defense for the assault was sometimes women just need slapping around.
For their feminine vapors.
Yeah.
Wow, who talks like that?
But in the UK, I don't know. But in
he should have taken the trolley out of there.
But his fiance, even though this happened on his, you know, bachelor night, she still married him. Hmm. But she's got 7 years to think about if she really wants to continue that, because he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. Now, here's a real master of defense, a guy named Michael Sampson. He managed to upgrade driving with a suspended license and littering to 5 felony charges in 20 seconds. Now, here's the way he did it. In some insane attempt to become the stupidest mime in history, during his trial, he pointed at a testifying police officer, the state prosecutor, and the judge, and made throat-slashing gestures. He also pointed at another police officer present, presumably for extra points, and mimed shooting someone. So they ended up charging him with the terroristic threats while he was in court.
Was he actually a mime?
No.
Oh, okay.
He was a very poor facsimile thereof.
He's like, they tried to come arrest him, but they couldn't because he was in a glass box.
Yeah, that's right. Doing his hands up around. You can't get to me.
They're all very confused.
Now, here's one, and his defense was he was too fat to die. In the case of Richard Cooey, he raped, tortured, and killed 2 college students in 1986. And last year, in proof that Satan is a lawyer and finds all this extremely funny, his legal team argued he was too fat to die. They argued that the cruel way we keep convicted and unrepentant double killers in cells led to his weight gain, although it didn't prevent him from trying to escape over a fence in 2005. Presumably, the judge pointed out that if Richard wanted to stay in shape, he should have chosen an exercise scheme which didn't involve double murder. They also argued that his medication might react badly to the lethal injection, at which point we have to ask, how much worse can they react? They're lethal injections.
Yeah.
So unless there's like a real chance of it accidentally creating a morbidly obese murderer with superpowers, I don't think that argument stands up.
Well, it goes to the whole cruel and unusual punishment. The whole point of the death penalty and the way it's supposed to be executed is that it's painless and whatever. It just ends their life. So if it interacts with somebody, then it could be considered cruel and unusual if it prolongs their death.
He raped and tortured and killed 2 people.
Now, I'm with you.
I don't think that I don't care if his fat drugs interfere with the injection. Let him go. Let it go, as they say on Frozen. Let it go.
Put a chip in him. Torture him. You know,
he doesn't need a chip. We know where he is. This one is. This goes to the one that you talked about earlier about not understanding the law.
Uh-huh.
This lawyer for George Thomas said that his client should not be found guilty of hijacking because he didn't understand that forcing his way onto an airplane, firing a gun into the ceiling, and taking everyone on board hostage was illegal. If he didn't understand that, how could you hold him responsible? No one had ever explained that to him.
There wasn't any signs.
No, they didn't specifically say you cannot carry a gun onto the plane, shoot at the ceiling, and hold everyone hostage. And if you don't say that, then there's no disclaimer on the ticket or the boarding pass or anything. Sounds logical, right?
Not really, but let's go with it.
Well, he didn't get away with it. Now, this is the last one, and this is my favorite. Michael Boyd, he says, I don't remember firing my shotgun at police, and if I did, it was an accident. So Michael Boyd's line is, I picked up the loaded sawed-off shotgun while surrounded by armed police, but I don't remember firing it. But just so we're all clear, the gun was totally fired at the police officers. During his trial, he further admitted he meant to get into an armed standoff with police, but only to teach his girlfriend a lesson. The said lesson being, she can't go running to the police every time he hits her. So, then he argued that he didn't actually punch her in the face, he only pushed her face. Minor technicality there.
Yeah.
And that the shootout, that he would have started it on purpose, no way, because there were kids in the house. Who would start a shootout with kids in the house?
The kind of guy that would punch a woman in the face like that, I think?
Well, probably so. So he just said, you know, he couldn't have started firing because he knew he didn't have enough shells to kill all the cops. So what sense would that make? Why would I start shooting when I don't have enough shells to kill everybody?
I imagine he got convicted.
Yes, he did get convicted. Absolutely.
That sounds like one of those clients that you would just sit there and bang your head against the wall representing.
Yeah.
I would not want to represent that guy.
I don't think anybody would want to represent that guy. I don't. You know, you have to wonder, though, on some of these, did these people really believe their own defense? Or was this just a way to get off of it?
I think they were crazy.
Well, yeah, I would say they were crazy. I don't know. Some of them, I just think they just found an excuse. I mean,
well, crazy and unwilling to accept culpability for their actions.
Well, that's true. Of course, that one guy, 16 alcoholic beverages and magic mushrooms. There's no telling what you might do after that.
That's true. That would be what I would call a voluntary intoxication.
Yes, that would be a voluntary intoxication.
Now, the one that we didn't talk about was involuntary intoxication, and that basically can be a complete defense to any kind of criminal liability. And that's whenever you have some sort of intoxicant that makes you temporarily insane. So again, you're lacking the mens rea for it. But essentially, to establish that kind of defense, what you have to show is that you really didn't know that you were taking this intoxicating substance, or that you didn't really fully comprehend its intoxicating qualities whenever you took it. So, for example, if you were prescribed some sort of medication and it had a weird interaction and made you unable to understand what was going on, then you can maybe assert that for in some sort of involuntary intoxication type defense. Or if possibly if you were roofied or something like that, and then you went out and did something, then you could maybe try to argue that as an involuntary intoxication
type
argument.
Slipped you a Mickey.
Exactly. So that is one thing that you can, as far as intoxication goes, can kind of assert that. But it would be a very bizarre fact pattern where you'd be able to prevail on that, I think.
Well, I think probably one of the things that you might get that might come to your aid is like if it was a driving thing.
Yeah.
Somebody slipped you something and you didn't know. I mean, maybe you weren't even drinking alcoholic beverages. Maybe somebody put something in your Coke or something, you know.
Uh-huh.
Not cocaine, but like Coca-Cola.
Right.
And you took that and then you got in your car and started driving, and then all of a sudden you didn't know where you were and had some kind of accident that involved hurting other people or something.
Yeah. A lot of states have actually passed laws that say you can't assert any kind of involuntary intoxication offense for driving laws like that.
Because really?
They don't want you to.
Well, so. Yeah, but what if it really happened?
What if?
Whoa, that's difficult.
I know. They should have chips in them so they can show where they went at all times to prove their innocence.
That's right.
Because they're all guilty until they're proven innocent, right?
That's right. And they've got these bands that you can wear that can monitor if you've been drinking alcohol or not and send it, transmit it back.
I've had a couple clients that have had to wear those.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, let's add that to the chip, too, so we can tell what's going on.
Sounds good to me.
Send it back to Central Control.
Sign me up, comrade.
We got us a runner. Call out the guards. Call out the robo beer.
I don't disagree with you. Or, I mean, I don't agree with you at all. I cannot disagree with you more.
I was going to say, you don't disagree with me?
Nope. Let's do it. Sign me up.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms and see if Tommy can remember what they are. So,
sure I can.
I'm sure you're going to remember this one. Mens rea.
Mental capacity.
Man, it's only about the sixth time we've had that. You nailed it.
I remembered it. I always think of men's, you know, products for, you know, deodorant and stuff like that.
Menin?
Mens rea.
What's mens rea's counterpart?
Actus rea.
That's right. And that's the actual physical act.
Yeah.
So those are the two things that compose pretty much any crime, the mental intent and the actual act.
Correct.
So you are on that
now.
I am on that.
So now there's no excuse because I know about it and I physically have been there.
So now there's two different kinds of mistake defenses. What are those?
Mistakes of law.
That's right.
And mistakes of fact.
That's right. The mistake of law is basically whenever there is a legal or factual mistake, which are not necessarily exclusive, but basically you misunderstood what the law is on something. And it can be complete defense.
But I've always heard ignorance of the law is no excuse.
That's true. But it can be a defense you can put forth.
Well, you can say anything, obviously, from some of these other idiots.
And then the last one is involuntary intoxication.
Involuntary intoxication is when you become intoxicated by no fault of your own.
That's right.
Somebody slips you a Mickey. And then something happens.
Somebody must have put something in one of those 15 beers I drank last night.
Yeah. And they also put a condom on me. I don't remember putting this on. Reminds me of the joke about the guy that woke up with the blue ribbon. I don't know where we were last night, but we must have won first place.
That's a Scotsman song. You've heard that, haven't you, the Scotsman?
No, I've heard it as a joke.
He's wearing a kilt?
No.
Lad, I don't know where you've been, but I see you won first prize.
Oh, okay. I understand with the rest of the joke there where it goes. Now, this guy was taking a shortcut through a cemetery and was getting caught peeing or something like that and grabbed the decoration off a grave or something like that to cover himself up. And so then he passed out and woke up the next morning with the blue ribbon on and said, I don't know where we were last night, but it looks like we won first prize.
Obviously, this is a time-honored classic joke that's been handed down through generations, many a different iterations of it.
It started out with, there once was a man from Nantucket.
something with a bucket? Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Sprung. And I'm just a dude.